Reggae Uprising with your host, Denise.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Reggae Uprising podcast, here for you every single Wednesday, connecting people of the African diaspora through inspiration, overstanding, wisdom, all backed by a soundtrack of sweet reggae music. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode, all of my regular listeners. If you are new, however, all you need to do to get caught up on those previous episodes is go to denile.co.uk. I will leave that link in the description for you to click away. And just so you know, every single Wednesday, I have a new guest which features and shares their story, their journey, their inspirations, and their wisdom for the betterment of all of us. Speaking of which, we're going to get started with today's guest's first selection, which is Tribesmen Back to Nature. Guest is an author, historian, journalist, and teacher who specializes in Black British history and literature. He wrote Britain's Slave Trade for Channel 4 Books, which accompanied its television documentary Windrush, An Incomparable World, charting the progress of three Black exiles living in 18th century London, and has written works of fiction for children to widen the consciousness and knowledge of the slave trade. I would like to welcome Steve Martin. Greetings and welcome, Steve.
Oh, good evening, Denise. Nice, lovely to be speaking to you.
I'm so happy that you could spare the time for us today and share your wisdom. Now, can you tell us the reason for that first selection we just heard?
Yeah, well, it's twofold, really. Firstly, it's the title, Back to Nature. And the natural world is something that I'm very fond of because it's something that my dad, at the time, almost forcibly introduced me to. He's from rural Antigua, and he wanted us, my brother and myself, to have some insight into the joys of nature. And we did have a quite rural upbringing, which was both good and bad. But the good part, of course, was that it instilled a love of nature and a joy in it, which I think is quite absent from a lot of our cultures, and I think it's quite sad, our sort of lack of connection to the natural world. And the second reason is that, yeah, Tribesmen, it was a group that that was from North London, and it's one of the first groups that I was listening to as a younger man when I moved from that rural situation into North London in the late 70s, early 80s. And of course, it's just beautiful music. It's a sort of music which, again, we don't really make very much nowadays. There's a lot of sentiment to it and emotional openness, which is absent from a lot of our artistic creation. And they were a North London band from Finsbury Park, Manor House. So that area has a lot of memories for me growing up as a younger man, yeah.
So you kind of touched on it in your answer to the question about your selection, but can you tell us a little bit more about your heritage? As this is a question that, you know, with us being people of the African diaspora, can you tell us what your heritage is?
Yeah, well, both my parents are from Antigua, and they were part of that larger or longer Windrush generation coming over in the very late 50s, 59, really. And my brother and myself were born here, and as part of our domestic education, my dad thought it was correct that we should have the benefit of living around nature, you know, chickens, rabbits, of growing our own vegetables. And to that end, we moved out to the country, which was country then, it's not so much country now. So we moved just outside where I was born, in the small town of Bedford. And we had chickens, rabbits. Dad had Alsatians, you know, we breed Alsatian dogs. We grew vegetables, we grew fruit, which is still up there. You know, my mum, at her old age, still enjoys that. Those are really strong memories on the positive side, I've got to say. So, those are really strong elements of my background, I'll say that.
So how much of your history, how much of the history of your heritage, should I say, were you aware of growing up? Was that something that was, you know, really important to your parents to instill into you, or was that something you found out about later on in life?
On the superficial general level, that came in, obviously through food, you know, eating fungi and duckno and conch and all of these things, which was a great blessing compared to the foods which were available in these islands in the 70s and the late 60s. So, but on a deeper level, no, a lot of it was religious education, which I was not fond of at all. And a lot of it was, to a degree, standardized English sort of education as well. So the history of, say, the uprising in Antigua, and the labour relations and of working people in Antigua, the histories of working people, those are things which came to me later on. But, you know, apart from the basic rights and wrongs, you know, there wasn't that heavy, heavy cultural overlay, I've got to say that.
So were you conscious of the traditions that were being passed on to you? You know, the small ones that you did mention, were you conscious of them being passed on to you in your family through the generations? Like, were you taught things from your grandparents that were passed, you know?
Yes, of course. You know, right. Basic, you know, manners, forms of address, and stories, family histories, which go back quite a long way to the 1850s. All of those things came through, but I don't think they were primary in my experience. Not until much later on, because, you know, it just was not what was happening immediately. No, there are other more pressing issues to do with psychological survival. I was too young to be processing a lot of that stuff as well.
Okay, so from your childhood, who would you say that your role models were? Who were the people that you looked up to and kind of, you know, aspired to be, or just inspired you in general?
I was of the generation we didn't really have them. I don't think the idea of role models, it's still something I struggle with, because I believe that people should be not so much self-starting, but have people in their immediate environment who just sort of like set the tone. And where I was growing up, their tone was set very much by the black community within the town. You know, there are certain things you didn't do. There are certain forms of expression you didn't use. There are certain ways you spoke to elders. A certain way you carried yourself. There's a standard of expectation, which I think was the role that I was modelling. It wasn't a particular individual. It's just the knowledge that, you know, you can't be dumb below a particular level. You can't be rude below a particular level. It's just social and cultural basics. But the idea of looking up to someone or other didn't come later until I decided, yeah, I wanted to be involved in literature. I wanted to write. And then I could see, you know, people like Claude McKay, like James Baldwin, like Zora Neale Hurston, who were just great creative minds, who had a lot to say. And I could say, yes, okay, this is something to pitch for. This is a level which resonates with me.
Okay, we're definitely going to delve deeper into your other works in history and literature. But for now, I want to move on to your next selection, which is Kojak and Mama Lisa. Too Bad Duffy. Why did you pick this one?
Okay, well, I picked Too Bad Duffy because, again, it reminds me of first coming down to London and that spectrum of music which was around in particularly the late 70s, that huge canvas of, you know, emotional, intellectual, political style, just in reggae, but also in jazz funk, which I loved at the time as well. All kinds of dance music and in every sort of black art and culture at the time, just a massive canvas. And Kojak and Mama Lisa, it's a nice joke song. It's levity, it's happy, it's laughing at superstition as well, which is something that is a very bad habit of mine, laughing at faith systems. So yeah, it cheered me up in many, many ways, and in some ways it sort of reminds me of my whole attitude to a lot of unproven belief systems.
Here we go with Kojak and Mama Lisa, Too Bad Duffy.
Too bad Duffy nuffy walk. Come and say too bad Duffy nuffy walk.
Come and say one half good and then the tara one bad. One half good and then the tara one bad.
But too bad Duffy nuffy walk. Come and say too bad Duffy nuffy walk. Me say me take a little walk down a Cayman as park. Yeah, the Duffy them a walk and a laugh. Man Duffy laugh a hoy.
Come and say woman Duffy laugh keng.
I saw the ghost, the lip on the wing. Man, you should I hear the cemetery I sing. Oh, they sing.
We dead, but we still enjoy good thing.
The ghost control the center.
We say that not a vampire could never enter.
The ghost dribble down the line.
But see ya, look how Duffy does a rocking by the line.
Too bad Duffy not be warm. Come and say too bad Duffy not be warm.
Come and say one half be good and then it are a one bad. One half be good and then it are a one bad.
And that for the matter of the last century, when I say Calvary versus Maypole Cemetery, and I man say I don't know so much of a baby, but a Calvary and Maypole Cemetery I would say. Come and say throw away the coffin manco.
Fireball.
Throw away the coffin manco. Come and say house and land and sell a dove cat.
We no want none of that.
And come on, we say that 1 o'clock,
2 o'clock,
3 o'clock, crack.
We no want none of that.
And come on, we say that 4 o'clock,
5 o'clock,
6 o'clock, crack.
We no want none of that.
And come on, we say that too bad, dumping up the wall. Come and say too bad, dumping up the wall.
Come and say 1 half be good and then the tara one bad. 1 half be good and then the tara one bad.
But too bad, dumping up the wall.
Can you tell us more about how you started that journey into literature and why you chose to go down that path?
Okay, that's fairly straightforward because it was something I always wanted to do since at a fairly early age, being literate. I always wanted to write because when I was reading, especially as a younger, as a child, I'd be reading children's books, and that just occurred to me, I think I could write better than this. I think I could have more interesting stories. And it became an obsession. I was just a complete obsessive reader. I'd be reading constantly, every moment of the day, if possible, as often as possible. And ultimately, you know, after dabbling in journalism, which I hated, it occurred to me that there was this huge gap in the histories that we are given to understand about ourselves, this massive gap around the communities and populations of African origin in these islands before the Windrush, and particularly the massive legacy of resources and written resources that we don't draw on. So, yeah, that was my main motivation for, you know, writing about the periods and the individuals and the novels as well that I write about.
So in looking into our history, when you first started your research, did you feel you were able to find what you were looking for straight away, or did it take a long, long time?
Straight away, immediately. Because where it hit me, or where it came to me in a bit more detail, is when I was looking at some drawings, some paintings rather, by William Hogarth from London in the 1730s. And I'd been living in London for some time by then. And when I saw Hogarth's paintings, it was a London I recognised. You know, I could recognise Covent Garden Piazza. I could have recognised Lower Regent Street. I recognised a lot of the places the artist was depicting in the 1730s. But what came as a bit of a surprise to me was seeing black people amongst them. When I say black people, I mean in a way that I had not seen black people before in that period. You know, they weren't in chains. They were not cowering in corners. They did not look in shackles or oppressed. They seemed just like people walking about. And my question was, who were these people? There seemed to be a few of them. How come no one's talking about them? How come this isn't part of the history that I was taught? And to answer your question, Daniel, yes, there's a huge amount of information. There's a tsunami of information. And it was very, very easy to research because at that time, only a handful of people were really interested in it. But it slowly, but not quickly enough for me, of course, edging towards the mainstream. But it's still got a long way to go before it becomes popular history, because there's a lot of opposition to learning about black histories in these islands before the Windrush.
And what do you feel the opposition is?
Oh, wow. How long have you got? Okay, very, very briefly. From the status quo, from the majority communities, there are a lot of people who are very uncomfortable with the idea of the black historical voice over the centuries, particularly what these voices had to say. You're talking about people like Ottoba Kuguano, to a lesser level, Olaudah Equiano, Robert Wedderburn, who are providing blueprints and solutions to problems that we still have today. These weren't oppressed people in the way we're comfortable with. And by us, I'm talking about the people of our heritages who, tragically, and this is the other side of the problem, have become comfortable with narratives of dispossession and dysfunction and inability. So when we look into the history, you know, we are sort of familiar with this because we have been shown this time and time again. But what these histories show us in particular are incredible stories of survival, of ingenuity, of radical thought, of writing, and just possibilities beyond the same old, that unfortunately too many of us are comfortable with.
And what do you think the reason is for that? Why do you think people are so comfortable with it? Do you think it's conditioning? Do you think it's a psychological trauma? Do you think it's just as simple as a disinterest? What do you think the root cause is, if there can be one root cause?
Okay, there are a couple of the main culprits. One, and I'm going to go into this seriously, is yes, disinterest. Because, again, due to a number of circumstances which can be changed, our remit of engagement with the world is tiny, and it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So there is resistance among us to just taking on board new knowledge, new ideas, or things outside this tiny, tiny remit. And unfamiliar histories are one of them. And especially these histories going back into the histories of people, black people in these islands, it doesn't have a lot of the elements which we have become addicted to, like glamour of a certain sort and religious elements of a certain sort. You know, it doesn't have that pull. It's just about serious, fantastic, hard-working, brilliant, ingenious human beings. So it just doesn't have that sort of televised, glossy pull. But at the same time, they're still, and for that reason, I think they're all the more amazing, these stories. Why do we struggle with them again? Because when we think about ourselves, we experience ourselves as, you know, being people of the present, people of the now, or people of the near past. Blackness is seen as synonymous, being of a piece with the contemporary, the happening, you know, the next new thing. But we don't, when we experience and envision ourselves, see ourselves going back at all. I mean, a lot of us don't have that sort of family history connection generationally. So that's another struggle in just seeing ourselves as part of a long series of histories. But yeah, it's not complex, but it's ugly and it's quite predictable. But yeah, on the other hand, you've got to say, yes, there are majority culture issues as well with it, because there are elements that seek to commodify these histories and make them just part of this big tapestry of British glorification or white British glorification. But yeah, bit by bit, the message is getting through still.
Wow. Okay, we're going to move on to your next selection, which is Augustus Pablo, King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown. Why did you pick this one?
Oh, again, because, you know, the thing is hard to say, because it's jolly, which is a weird word when you're talking about music nowadays. But it's jolly and it's cheerful. And even saying those words, jolly and cheerful, is sort of bad, because you can't really describe a lot of culture nowadays, you know, using these adjectives, but it is resolutely so. And it just reminds me of holidays and anywhere sort of rural, non-urban, and just fresh air and sunlight. And it's a sort of piece. It's a go-to, just restful piece of music.
Here we go with Augustus Pablo, King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown. What the process was like writing your first book?
Oh, it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. I wrote it in about 3 months, and it was a fever dream state. I was living it and experiencing it, almost hallucinating it. And obviously it was set in London. So as I was walking around various parts of London, that it was set, like Tottenham Court going through is a hallucinatory experience, because I mean, I do a huge amount of research, every form of, you know, archive research, newspapers, portraits, architectural drawings, at a granular, boring, nerdy level. I love it. But it lets me rebuild the environment that my characters walk through. So, yes, it took three hallucinatorily intense months to get out of the way. The first edition, as a first draft, I should say. We'll get that one to the publishers. And the publishers looked at it and said, yes, we want it, which was a surprise. But, yeah, so from there, yeah, I've been in print.
So what was that like, first, you know, because you've got the creative side done, you've like you just said, you've had that hallucinate experience. What was it like having to deal with the business side of things? And it's kind of like your baby now that you're passing on to other people to look at and analyze. And what was that process like?
Well, you're correct in using that comparison. No, the baby process. Well, the child has grown up, has a life of its own. And, you know, you wave farewell and wish it well, because it's no longer in your control. But the problem was, I found, and this was a problem, what happened partially was what I didn't want, which was that it would end up in the coffee tables of Hampstead, you know, in the hands of, the arts intelligentsia, the traditional liberal arts intelligentsia. And to a degree, that's what did happen. And that affected how I was going to produce other pieces of writing. And I decided that, yes, I'd be writing historical books for young people as well, as well as non-fiction. But I'd also be writing historical books for young people, especially young men who seem to have very little engaging histories or new stories told for them.
With that in mind, can you tell us more about your other works?
Yes, in particular, the Jupiter Williams books. Jupiter Williams was created from real characters who were living in Sierra Leone at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, late 1700s, early 1800s. And they came from very diverse backgrounds. I don't want to say too much because I will bore you, guaranteed. But when I say diverse backgrounds, including some families of Maroons from Jamaica who were sent out of the island after the Second Maroon Wars, they ended up making it back to Africa, where, of course, with their exposure to Europeans in terms of commerce, in terms of language and behavior and skill, they are part of this huge new growing upper class, or, want for a better word, Creole culture, which is superimposed on top of the traditional African cultures in that part of West Africa. But there are other people as well, you know, free black people from North America, black loyalists from America. But it's a hodgepodge of people who become this really dynamic, creative, business-minded group of black people, some of whom send their children to this school in London, the African Academy, which actually existed. And it's there that the main character has a number of experiences which lead him to make very, very serious decisions about his life and where he's going with it.
Okay, we're going to move on to your next selection, which is Black Uhuru, The Whole World is Africa. Why did you choose this selection?
Oh, that's an easy one, because, Michael Rose and Co, Sly and Robbie, is just one of the greatest combinations of drum, bass and lyricists and singers. And, that song is just a general sort of anthem, just seeing what we do and who we are and how things work out, having an African origin and an African meaning, ultimately. So, it's just a great piece of music.
Here we go with Black Uhuru, The Whole World is Africa.
The whole world is Africa, but it's divided in continents.
in the works that you have produced, what five things do you believe were the hardest to find in your research? Now, I know as a whole, you said it wasn't that difficult for you to find things in your research, but there must have been specific elements that were harder to find. What, if we could pick five of them, what would they be?
Well, that's really hard. I mean, it's an obsession. Research is an obsession with me. But I would say some of the literature and the written lives. And this is one thing which is very important to me, because we, in, if you're brought up in this these islands, in the British Isles, what we're given to understand about black history is often just taken completely and uneditedly from North American histories, African American histories, and just plonked on us as if that's our stuff. And it's very important for me to retrieve these histories of people who were living here and what they wrote. So some of the writings have been a journey to find. Also, five things, wow. The beliefs, how and why they believed what they believed. Because you see, again, the whole belief systems are something which fascinate me for all sorts of reasons. And how people created communities of faith, how people joined various religious institutions, how religious institutions worked for them. And also business, which is a huge area which is revealed. The fact that there were an astonishing number of black business people, you know, in the 1700s and 1800s, whether it's people, a gentleman having a coal haulage business up and down the Thames, Caesar Picton, whether it's George Africanus in Nottingham with his employment agency, whether it's Robert Wedderburn with his printing in London, or whether it's Frederick Ziegler, or Bill Richmond, one of the many, many, many black pub owners, or Ignatius Sancho with his fruit and veg, or with his grocery shop, one of a number of black grocers. All of these things really fascinate me, but, you know, they've been a bit hard to pin down, but I think they're important because they show the virtue of, you know, being self-starting, having faith in oneself, and a sort of vision which seems to be lacking nowadays when it comes to commercial ventures, sustainable commercial ventures. And, you know, as I always believe, the lessons are in history somewhere. What else? Oh, yeah, music. That's a hard one, because although we have some examples of mimicry, as I would call it, of European style, I'm still on the trail of like popular forms of music from the 18th and early 19th century, from the 1700s and early 1800s. That's something I'm still trying to track down. I've only got fragments of that. And let me see if I can get to a fifth. There must be one. Yeah, some of the military records are a bit difficult as well. You know, from the early 1800s, from the Napoleonic Wars on land, those are quite hard to find because they didn't always include the racial description in some of these records. So there are a few wrong paths which can be taken. So yeah, that's fine.
So if there's anybody out there listening and they've done research in any of those subjects just mentioned and they would like to connect, make sure you check out the link in the description and connect, because that's what this show is all about. The next question I want to ask you is, what surprised you most about our history? So was there anything in doing your research you were like, wow, oh my gosh, you know, that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, first of all, the how much of it was there, and how much is still there, the volume of it, and how widespread the black presence was, you know, the ubiquity of it from Glasgow to Anglesey in Wales to all parts and every part of this country, and expression of black identity and, you know, human potential. Because I said in my opening statement, you know, there are certain narratives we're attached to now about our own potential and possibility. So when you see some of these characters from history, they do challenge that directly. So, yeah, that's always the prize, to see the spectrum and enjoy the spectrum of humanity.
And what would you say are the three biggest lies we are told about our history? I know.
Well, firstly, that we don't have any. That's first of all. And that's the big one. Secondly, that we don't have a particular history here. That, you know, we just sort of appeared in 1948, stepping off the Windrush with those 492, mostly Jamaican, mostly men. That's the biggest lie of all, because that's a lie which keeps us, as I say, always locked in the present and blocks off all of this information, all of these resources, all of this literature, these legacies before 48 are totally locked off from our imaginations. So it's a way of stopping ourselves from rebuilding, from, you know, recreating literally who we are and what we do and how we do it. Third biggest lie, again, you know, the nonsense that, you know, we were all slaves. Now, of course, that is the big story up until 1837. That's the big story between, as far as these islands are concerned, 1560s and 1837-38. That lie, of course, locks us in to a particular set of experiences which are all about dispossession and all about trauma. Whereas, you know, the histories I am more interested in are ways of solving that, ways around it, about solutions and using some of those experiences in positive ways.
We're going to move on to your next selection, which is Zigzawa Dadita. Why did you pick this one?
Okay, there's nothing positive about this piece of music at all, apart from it's a brilliant piece of music. From, you know, the very opening bars, which just take you into this, like, spooky... and the ghostly mutterings as he is describing, basically describing his firearm. This is a very bad piece of music. It's a, you know, really slack, nasty little piece of music. But it's musically incredibly, incredibly inventive, and it's quite witty, and yes, it just reminds me again of just a more creative, I mean, there are all sorts of discussions we can have about negative impact and effects of music, but this piece of music is almost quaint compared to a lot of the select pieces, similar pieces which are created today. And there is still a genuine levity and a sense of fun about it.
Here we go with Zigzawa Dadita.
Well, all road boy and all article gunman, all bad boy about the place. When all them have them gun, when I got no gun like mathematics, and I look a finger gun like 38. When I talk about gun like Zigzaya, blow them house and tear up volcano. See? All bad boy, hear me now. Hey, and it zigzag, come now. New gun we get it, daddy. New gun we get me ball. New gun we get it, daddy. New gun we get, come follow me. New gun we get it, daddy. New gun we get me ball. New gun we get it, daddy. New gun we get, come. Jump around, you have your gun by your hip. Pam pam, holla out, by your no delicate. Pam pam, make them know you're not shoot and miss. Car knife days done, cut last days finish. Buckle and stone, you know we done with it. Pam pam, bad boy, them no fight face to face. If I face you, I come with, well, you dead as Nate. Cause we
fire beer bush master and matic. Pam pam lick a shotty cause you magnum a click. Pam pam lick a shotty cause you nine a stick. Police and soldier beer shot them a lick. Pam pam bad boy now rampy boss it me got me ziggy pa me hit me now skin up with it. Neither the Taurus nor the chopstick nor the German Luger or the one in remit. Pam pam zigzag you too big for carry it and the
If you had to pick five unknown heroes of Black history, who would they be and why?
Oh, wow. On the spot. First of all, Claudia Jones. I mean, she's post-Windrush, but there is someone who was one of the godmothers of the Notting Hill Carnival. She had one of the earliest, well, probably the foremost post-Windrush black-centered publication, the West Indian Gazette. She, and this West Indian Gazette was a phenomenal publication published on Brixton Road, which was seriously looking at politics, entertainment. It was looking at trivia. It is a sort of publication which is hard to imagine nowadays, having an audience, but it was just widely read. And, she just everything she said, could almost be quoted. What did she write? What did she say? A people's art is the genesis of their future, clearly stating the art forms that are produced will condition who you will be in the future, which is absolutely true. Now more than ever, that's the case. Una Marson, again, she was the first playwright to be featured as a West End, have a West End play. At what price? In the early 30s, actually, could have been 37. But she was also part of the League of Coloured Peoples, and the League of Coloured Peoples were one of the early 20th century black civil rights groups. She was also actively working with Haile Selassie and his crew when they were in exile. She was a great poet as well, one of the forgotten great poets, writing in the 1930s while living here, poems like Kinky Hair Blues, obviously describing her relationship to her hair and the historical background to that. She's writing songs, she's writing poems, one was just called The N-Word, if you follow me, and that was describing how her experiences of walking along the streets of South London in the 1930s and having young people just scream that word in her face. And other stuff she did about media, basically all of that stuff could have been written yesterday. It could be written tomorrow. It's just very, very, very powerful, resonant stuff, which I use with young people. And when I do school sessions, especially Kinky Hair Blues and the N-word poem, and it's understood, it stands the test of time. My favourite person of all, Robert Wedderburn, who was a firebrand Jamaican who published the best book on enslavement, I think, The Horrors of Slavery, which is his sort of autobiography. He was of mixed background, mixed race. His father was a plantation owner. His mother was one of the enslaved people his father owned. And he was brought up with his black family. And the most traumatic experience of his life was seeing his grandmother laid out face down on the ground, being flogged almost to death by a European in Jamaica who believed that his elderly relative had cast a spell, worked obia on his ship, which sank in Kingston Harbour. And that one event caused him to be against both organized religion and an institution. Those are two things which are very close to my heart anyway. You know, challenging organized religion and enslavement of all kinds. And he wrote profusely in huge, just a vast amount of writing on a whole selection of subjects. I haven't got time to talk to him about him in depth because I am his biggest fan. But I think in the near future, we'll be looking at editions of his work coming out, because I think everyone should have this stuff. Everyone should have his writing. They're genuinely revolutionary. The other person I'd mention, I think we're on four. Actually, we're on four or five.
Four.
We're
on four.
yeah, I'll also mention Otto Bakugwano. A lot of people talk about Lauda Equiano, and although I can't, no one can take what Equiano did away from him, there's very much the sense that Equiano was playing to the gallery, that he's being the good, hard-working, honest, upstanding Christian, whose, though his skin was black, his soul was white, having been washed in the blood of Jesus, etc., etc., which is very, very pleasing to the status quo. People like Robert Wedderburn, who I just mentioned, and Otto Bakugwano, is my fourth, I think, selection, took a different view. Kugwano's take on it was that economic independence was top, front, and center of everything, and that there had to be a case, which he was making in 1787, which he was making in 1787. There had to be a case for reparation, that there have to be industries built on the continent of Africa. And yeah, he was saying all of this hundreds of years ago, but not enough people really read him because, again, it's not glamorous. There's no big option. There's no magic. There's no mystery. So he's a hard sell. The last person, simply because he's so weird, is Captain John Perkins of Jamaica, who was one of the thousands of black seafarers and sailors in the Royal Navy in the 1700s and 1800s. But he actually became a captain of a frigate with over 240 men, mostly white, under his command. Now, I don't think he was a good person, because you couldn't be to have that sort of post in that sort of place. But he's an extraordinary one, especially given the fact that here he was with white people under his command, hundreds of them, at a time of the transatlantic slave trade. And given what went on board these ships, naval vessels, you know, he would have been issuing punishment and, you know, rewarding people with lashes. He's just such a strange person that I just find him infinitely fascinating, if not ultimately good.
Some amazing people. Definitely going to look those up. I know everybody listening is as well. We're going to move on to your next selection, though. Woman Dea, Professor Nuts, why did you pick this selection?
Again, it's funny. Just his use of language, how you just start talking about walking to going to a dance in Manchester one November, and it's the really crisp way he describes how he just walks into this dance, and he says "Owase" and Tamil brethren say "Waya." He says so much using such minimal language. And he describes the situation perfectly, and you can imagine. And he goes around calling up all these women he knows. It's fun, and it's detailed, and it's just full of a lot of memories as well of good times that I've had.
Here we go with Woman Dea, Professor Nuts.
Quiet! And listen to the lyrics, I'm so nice. Lord, just listen and understand the trouble. Woman there, you see, woman there. No, me take in a dance from Manchester. I think it was sometime last November when me go in a dance.
man up your man day, your man day, man up your man day. So me come out and they dance, jumping on me under. Me hear a man say, lad, you gone, professor. Me say, me soon come back. Tell the promoter, say, me gone, look, man, fi come back on ya. So me drive up a Portmore Edgewater. Me wake Angela, we live at the corner. Me wake up Sharon, me live at Coronado. She run, go fi Ellen, that a she bigger sister. Then me carry long pan, big body, Sophia, Lenky, Titi, Arlene, Maga, Futanita, Jayet, Paula, Dash, Rebelli, Elena, Nyame, Nyame, Marcia, Dalali, Dong, Sonia, Barat, Mount, Jai, Stati, Chatelina, Sexy, Grape, Rose, Lazy, Body, Maria, Long Neck, Gina, Fanos, Paline, Picky, Picky, Head, and Jones, Jotty, Nesri. Me did say, enough man, they are but a woman, they are weak. Woman day, you see, woman day, me this enough man day, but a woman day, what? Woman day, you see, woman day, plus Peggy, 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 take a reg melody, Molly, and Rebecca, Donkey, Fierce, Nana. When me kill them, they dance, every man feel better. Hell a man stop, loaf and start by liquor. Every man hold a woman and a bubble under. Me hear a man say, Lord, me comfort on ya, because woman day, too much woman day.
Can you tell us about your future work? So what have you got planned for maybe the end of this year as we come into the end of it, or possibly 2021?
Okay, well, currently, well, as we speak, there's an exhibition on at the Old Royal Naval College, the ORNC, which I've curated, and it's entitled Black Greenwich Pensioners. And it's looking a handful of the many, many lives of black men who were former Royal Naval seamen, and in the 18th and 19th century in particular, who became pensioners at Greenwich Hospital, basically the Navy's equivalent to the Chelsea pensioners. The Chelsea pensioners were red. The Greenwich pensioners used to, they finished in the 1860s, 1869, they used to wear blue. So we're looking at these extraordinary lives, and what we find, as you find everywhere with these stories, that these people came from everywhere, from every rank of life. For example, Mr. John Thomas, who was actually a runaway from a plantation in Barbados because he was a carpenter. He was allowed to board a naval vessel, join the Royal Navy, as did at the other extreme, someone like Fred Zegula, who was he was the landlord, one of the many black landlords. Interestingly, he was the landlord of the Cock and Lion pub on Wigmore Street. He was the landlord in 1808 as a black man. But that public house still stands, and they are still, as they say, pulling pints in there. So, yeah, that's going on until that exhibition's continuing until February, 21st of February next year. My first novel is being turned into an opera by the Chicago Opera Company. And I mean, I'm not the world's biggest fan of opera, but the Chicago Opera Theatre, I should have said. And I can only just wait and curiously see how that's going to transpire. I'm also working with the David Livingstone Trust, yes, that David Livingstone Trust, to try and change its display and its general offer into something more suitable for the 21st and meaningful for the 21st century and multiple diverse audiences.
Sounds like you're really, really, really busy. And yeah, I can't wait to check out all of those things that you just said. I really can't. But the final question I want to ask for you, because we're running out of time, is having studied our past, and, you know, history is so relevant to the present day in, you know, in making sure our future is positive and, you know, is not repeating our history. Was there any wisdom that you'd like to share with the listeners for our future that might help them along their journeys?
Yes, there is. And it's from my favourite person from history, Robert Wedderburn. He was a genuine revolutionary. And one of my favorite quotes from him is that it is demeaning to human nature to petition one's oppressors. It is demeaning to human nature to petition one's oppressors. And I just think that's just infinitely applicable to so many situations where there are all sorts of expectations of sort of mercy or common goals with oppressive entities and individuals. But with Robert Wedderburn's advice, you know, one does not petition, one does not sing Kumbaya. And that's why I really, really rate him as probably the leading individual from Caribbean culture who appears in the histories of these islands.
Right, we're going to finish off with your final selection, Capleton. Slew Them. Why did you choose this selection?
Because I couldn't resist. I just could not resist it. I don't have a good thing to say about him as an individual or his views, but as a performing artist, he's second to none. He has great vision, just unbelievable amounts of energy and creativity. And I defy anyone not to enjoy his music. If you take his whole personality and belief set away from it, it's just great, great, great art. He's a great artist.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with all of us today. I've really appreciated the knowledge that you've shared. Thank you so, so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Delia. My pleasure.
Right, we're going to finish off with Capleton, Slew Them. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Make sure you tune in next Wednesday. I hope you have a wonderful week. As always, blessed love.
Ruben, what are we going to do? Slew Them! Who there? Who there? Well done. Yo, some may say again. Slew them up, be a feelings, them a carry. Them done, but already, and them can't say them sorry, yeah. Slew them up, be a feelings, them a carry. Who no want to do them something again? Well, you what you with me? Who them a could have that them a try? Them got this king, still I see what you all like them die, yeah. Who them a make see them with them spell? Them this money well, and them so gonna hell, yeah. Who them a could have who them walk us? Them this Marcus, I know them all by the dust, yeah. Who them a make tell them this blur? Tell them can't.